I'm Evan Smith of the Texas Tribune, and this is Point of Order, a podcast about the ins and outs, the ups and downs, the people and the politics and the topics and the traditions of the 86th Texas Legislature. This week, fixing school finance, what it will take and what it will cost. Everyone else is talking about it. Why shouldn't we? And no wonder. It's the largest share of the state budget every biennium, and it's the most important aspect of the most important policy area state lawmakers grapple with over the 140 days of a session. The new House Speaker, Dennis Bonin, has put it at the top of his agenda for the 86th, and the governor and lieutenant governor have each done the same. This is partly an exercise in playing offense. The brightest possible future of Texas depends on a public education system that produces thoughtful citizens, a vibrant workforce, and ample opportunities for all, and partly about playing defense. Voters last November strongly suggested that this better be the session when real progress is made on school finance, or there will be hell to pay in 2020. During the interim, a school finance commission convened to study the problem and unanimously approved a set of recommendations heading into session. And one of the members of that commission is my guest this week. Dan Huberty, a Houston Republican, chaired the House Public Education Committee last time around and is the odds-on favorite to return in that role this time. He knows the substance and the politics of school finance as well as anyone. We talked on the afternoon of January 9th, 2019, day two of the 86th session, as the hard work on this thorny issue was just beginning. Point of Order is supported by Educate Texas, stimulating creative solutions to key educational challenges throughout the state. Learn more at edtx.org. And by the Texas Education Grantmakers Advocacy Consortium. Our members work to protect, promote, and improve public education in Texas for all students. Connect with us at tgac.org. And by Raise Your Hand Texas. Raise Your Hand Texas identifies breakthrough ideas to improve education, pilots them in our public schools, and supports the conditions and public policies allowing them to scale to benefit all Texas students. More at RaiseYourHandTexas.org. Why is this so hard? Existentially, we can do so many things in the world. We put a man on the moon. I can pause live television, right, in my house.
Yep.
You fix all kinds of big problems that cost billions and billions of dollars. This is the one thing over the years that you've not been able to fix.
Yeah, and you know, this is my fifth session, and we've tried to fix it the past four times, and there was people before me that tried to fix it.
Many years before you got to the legislature,
yeah,
this was tried and failed.
I think, you know, and as much of a initially I was a skeptic about the school finance commission, which I served on, I think we ended up in a great place. And I think that the realities of the situations are is that you can't keep doing the same thing and expect a different result, which is what we're getting. And we're not
right.
Getting the results that I think all of us want for our kids.
Do you doubt that people who came before you in this role or other members of the legislature did not want to fix this? They all had the same desire to fix it
yeah.
that you do.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think about Chairman Aycock before me and Chairman Eisler, and, you know, before him, you know, it was Kent Grusendorf, you know,
right.
Keep going back. And yeah, every single one of them have tried. And I know Chairman Aycock, I think the big here's really what it came down to, and he taught me a lot of good lessons. But you have to have the ability to educate your colleagues, but at the same time, you have to get everybody kind of rowing together. And what I mean by that is the school districts themselves.
Yeah,
they become the biggest obstacles because you know if you look at what we're going to do, you got to envision the whole plan. You got to look at everything, not just little pieces. And so when we
and everybody only cares about their piece.
That's
or
right.
Thinks about
that's
their
that's
piece.
Exactly right.
Human
and,
nature.
That's right. And so what that's the, some of the things that I shared with them is that you know look, you can't just think about one thing. You got to think about the entirety of the plan, and
yep.
That's the only way it's going to work.
When you talk about the local people being a part of this conversation and that they can be an obstacle, do you mean the professional class, the educators, or do you mean the volunteer class, the school board members? You were a school board member for
yep.
many years. You ran your school board.
Yep.
You know what it's like to be on that side of the conversation.
Sure. I think it's both. I think it's the associations that represent various size schools, as an example.
Right.
You know, I recognize that suburban districts have different needs from urbans that are different from rurals,
right?
Different from poor districts than wealthier districts. I mean, they all have different needs and wants. And so one of the things that we tried to do last session, we tried to pass a reform last session.
Right.
But we brought everybody into the room and had conversations with them. And so what we did this time for the last year that we've been working on, we've brought people into the room and let them be part of the conversation. And so that's how a lot of the ideas were crafted.
They love participating on the front end. The question is whether they love the byproduct of that work on the back end.
Right.
And the problem is all that kumbaya, everybody together in a room, we're all rowing in the same direction to pick your preferred phrase, is all good until the point at which you make a decision and there are winners and losers.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, it's always funny the day that we call them our runs, as the school runs.
Right. Where they produce these spreadsheets that show here's how every district is affected by every.
That's exactly right. And so what happens that day is you know who's going to be with you or against you.
Right.
Based upon what happens in their school district. Right.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that we made sure of that we did this time is that we looked at. We had some ideas of money that we were talking about putting in and the changes and things of that nature, but all the different groups, education consulting groups that are out there, try to come up with, you know, their own interpretation of the runs of what they would look like.
Right.
And so I started getting calls from school districts, and I listened, and then we stopped, and I know Chairman Taylor had the same kind of things, and we said you can't just look at the one piece.
Yep.
You got to look at all these different things together, and it's all going to be a function of the revenue and the money that gets into the program. So that's going to be critical.
You mentioned the School Finance Commission. You mentioned, which I also know to be true, that you were not 100% for this idea.
Yeah.
What had preceded it was you had worked very hard on legislation over the course of the session, got down to the 3-yard line, say,
right.
Couldn't get the ball across the goal.
Right.
Come back in special session. We're going to try to take this up again. Can't really get it any further close to the goal than you did the last time. And there's a decision instead to kick this to a commission. And people like me in the press, people who've been watching it for a long time go, why do you have to study this?
Right.
You've been studying it. All you've done is studied it.
Right.
Just fix it. So you went in a skeptic. And the process that you went through had you traveling around the state during the interim, meeting with various people. Mm-hmm. But it was a positive experience.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah.
And I think that it was very interesting. And I told this to Chairman Brister, who chaired the commission. You know, I said the first few meetings were kind of, you know, public ed 101, and you know,
right.
You kind of, you know, for those of us who have been around a long time, you're like, oh gosh, we got to sit through this, but it ultimately became very beneficial, and there was a lot of ideas and concepts, and the one thing of it is that he, as the chairman and the way it was run, was very inclusive to everybody, to let them have a seat at the table and have a say.
Right.
Now that doesn't mean we did exactly what they wanted to do.
You had appointees on this commission from the speaker's office, from the governor's office, from the lieutenant governor's office. So you had people of different ideological perspective, people who came at this from different sides of the education conversation, but you were able to work happily, productively side by side.
Yeah, and that was the best part of it. You know, and I was involved, and I chaired the expenditures group. We had 3 different work groups: expenditures, revenues, and outcomes. And so I had the opportunity to have work with one of the State Board of Education members, Kevin Ellis, and then obviously Larry Taylor, Scott Brister, and Royce West. And so that was great because, you know, Royce has perspectives that we don't have. He represents, as a senator, he represents a different, different demographics than what I represent.
Right.
And so it was really good from my perspective to get input from everybody along the way of what we think we should do. And especially people that have been around a long time.
You had insiders and outsiders.
Yeah.
You had Democrats and Republicans. You had House and Senate. And the fault line last session was as much House and Senate as it was anything. But you and Larry Taylor in particular, as I understand it, have found something close to common purpose here.
Yes.
To the point that you were able to work well together and could imagine yourselves working together well and better this next time.
I think that's absolutely accurate. And,
yeah.
And, you know, Larry has been a great partner in this, and you know we joke, we've seen each other so much, you know, we're kind of getting sick of each other, you know, but we're really not, because we've spent so much time trying to figure out what the best way to solve this problem so that we can get it done. I mean, that's really what the issue is. Let's not have the fight. You know, let's figure out, you know. And look, we may disagree on a couple things, and so that'll be part of the process.
So we're sitting here in early January. It was right before Christmas, December the 19th, I believe, that you all unanimously voted to approve this report. There were more than 30 recommendations in the report. There are things like investing in dual language programs and improving reading levels, teacher evaluation metrics, pay for performance. Yep. You all agreed on that stuff.
Yep.
It's not necessarily stuff that no one can disagree with, but generally speaking, who's opposed to making these different aspects of education better if you can figure out how to do it and how to pay for it, right?
Yeah, I think here's where we saw some pushback. So it's the process of the teacher incentive pay.
Right.
You know, we talked a lot about what they call the ACE program in Dallas. But, you know, we said, well, we're not going to just adopt one plan. We're just not going to say, oh, Dallas, you did such a great job. We're going to take this one plan. What we said was you have to get it a bottom-up driven process. And this is important, where the teachers are involved in the process of the evaluations and the incentives, but we got to get money into the classrooms where they belong the most.
Right.
I think whether it's on the Republican side or the Democrat side, I've heard feedback. Oh, just you know, they don't need more money. The system doesn't need more money. It doesn't need this. It doesn't need that. But we're looking at it from our perspective that says we're redistributing the resources we have, but more importantly, we're going to expect better results.
Right.
And
this is outcomes-based funding, for lack of a better phrase,
right? Exactly right. And we're willing to pay for it. Yeah. You know, we get better results, you're willing to pay.
So let's talk about the willing to pay for it part. I want to go back to the special session where there was a proposal floated as one of the governor's list of items on the called special. We're going to increase teacher pay. I've heard the lieutenant governor talk about increasing teacher pay as one of the things he thinks is most important this session. As a matter of fact, the state can't increase teacher pay.
That's right.
Teacher pay is only increased by districts.
Right.
So if you mandate a pay increase and you don't increase the amount of money going to those districts, it's an unfunded mandate, is it not? How are you going to avoid? You don't know for certain that you're going to put more money into public ed. You think you are. Mm-hmm. You've got a list of recommendations that I think total something like $1,700,000 if you did everything end to end, right, in this report. But we don't know for a fact that you all are going to increase public education funding.
Well,
so how do you increase teacher pay if you don't increase public education?
You know, so as you just mentioned, you know, second day, third day in, obviously we're talking to appropriators and figuring out what resources are going to be. But you're right, you know, and we don't know what that number is going to. We don't know what the final number is going to be, and we don't know none of those things until you get to the floor, and you know that's when it all happens. We have some ideas of how much resources that we're talking about, and it's significant.
Right.
Part of it is it's got to go hand in hand with the tax reforms and tax relief and everything else. That those are going to be important things that go with there. But specifically on teacher pay, the last time the legislature mandated teacher pay was 2009. And that was when they had the Fed money that came in. And I was on the school board at that time. And I remember them basically saying, you got to give everybody $1,000. And then what did we do in 2011? We cut funding in education by $5 billion.
Right.
So not only did we not fund the mandatory
pay
raise.
You went the other direction.
We went the other direction.
Right.
And so it created a lot of problems that's associated with that. And I think what the governor has said and what the lieutenant governor has said, and we did not pass that proposal in the
special
session.
Right.
And for a variety of reasons, because I just think you can't just completely shake that whole system up in a 10-day period of time. You have to go through the process of getting there. We're talking about incentive pay or increasing pay for, you know, putting teachers in Title I campuses or districts where it's hard, or in specialty programs for special ed teachers and things of that nature. That's what we're trying. And, oh, by the way, if you're a, you know, 10-year teacher, taught for 10 years, and you would go and get your master's degree, or go get your PhD or something along those lines. The only way to make $90,000 to $100,000 is you go to administration. Well, we're saying, well, there's a lot of good teachers don't want to do that.
Stay in teaching. And you think the school districts and the teachers and everybody else who would have a point of view about this are all on board with that idea?
Well, I think there's certainly school districts and school boards that I've talked to that are worried about, you know, what they had back in the 80s, which was the career ladder, right? Same type of a prospect, and then you just didn't fund it, right? And so we're not doing that. We've got it in the base, you know, in the base bill, so to speak, of how that would get there. But again, we want them to be involved in the design of the program. We're not gonna top down drive this thing. We're gonna, you know, bottom up drive.
There was a point of controversy toward the end over the question of putting a number in the report. right?
Yes. There
was a dollar figure in an earlier version that I think it was $1.73 billion in new funding that was necessary to enable all the things in the recommendations. Right. And by the end, you all took the number out as a point of compromise.
Right.
There was also another point of compromise in that there was language that blamed the state for failing schools.
Yeah.
And that also came out as a point of compromise. And you said at the time, I think we have failed our schools and we haven't funded them, in my view, adequately or equitably. You're on the record. You're transparent about it.
Absolutely.
But the report does not point a finger because it was thought that, well, this will offend the very people we're trying to bring in to this conversation.
Yeah.
Why not just be honest about it?
Well, I think there was a couple things. You know, Chairman Brister, as the chairman, obviously was very collaborative with us. But you know, he's a former Supreme Court justice, and you know, he looks at things from a law perspective, where I look at things from a different perspective. You know, I think about what we should be doing, and I think you should be honest and open about it and talk about it. And I think he had some legitimate concerns about some of this stuff.
Now, he thought you were opening yourselves up to a potential lawsuit.
He was concerned about that, and so you know, and there was a couple other lawyers that were on there, and that visited with us and talked to us. And so I got that, but if you look at the back of the report, it is very prescriptive on what we should be spending on these. So it wasn't in the executive summary necessarily.
But you call out almost like an a la carte menu what
right.
you need to do, and somebody
right.
who does simple math can come up with the number.
Absolutely.
So you feel like you accomplished the goal?
I do.
I think through another door.
I think so, and I think that ultimately, you know, the messaging that people need to understand is that. Again, and we've been very clear on this, is that you can't just look like at one component. Like, for example, we got rid of cost of education index.
Right.
We said, hey, if we're not going to study, if LBB is not going to study it, we're not going to figure out what it really costs. It's a meaningless number. You know, let's put that in a different place. And so I think we're not taking the money away. We're just using it differently.
Yeah.
And so I think that if we can do the entirety of what we're recommending, and I promise you this, there's you know, this isn't just the only ideas that are out here this legislative
right.
session. I mean, people got tons of bills that had filed on certain little pet projects and things of that nature. But I've learned over the years that the best way to get this thing done is to get both of us to kind of agree where we're going to land, and get as close as possible.
So if the report does not specify a number in so many words, mm-hmm. that you should do it for me. Right now, if you ran the world, King Huberty, you wave your scepter over this place, what is the right number?
Well,
what Speaker Strauss said on the way out the door.
Sure, yeah.
It's sort of like an unexploded bomb. He said, I think you should put in $5 billion.
Sure.
I think you have $5 billion.
Sure.
Is that a good number?
Well, look, the answer is I want to steal the thunder from the appropriators. There is a number that there's been battered around that is significant. Very significant.
When you say it's been battered, let me stop you there. What does that mean, it's been battered around?
They're talking about putting a number in what we would see as the base bill of where that would be. I don't think they've come to a landing.
Is it an over and above number?
It's a significant number.
Is it a number above enrollment growth? So
yes.
It's a positive number.
It's a positive number, absolutely.
Is it larger?
You can't do the stuff that we want to do without
right.
those additional resources. And my view of it was this. And by the way, you can't do the property tax reform that you want. So I'm going to give you an example.
Yeah.
The property growth when TEA submitted their LAR, they assumed two things, 6.9% growth on property taxes and $3.5 billion of what we would consult property growth or valuation growth coming back to us from the school districts.
Right.
Okay? And so we look at that and say, well, we want to achieve not only school finance reform, but property tax reform and property tax relief. Well, you can't take the $3.5 billion and go spend it on something else. You got to give it back to the taxpayers. And that's one mechanism to do that. You know, we've got recapture that's growing. We've got a lot of issues that are significant resources. You know, we're going to collect about $2.6 billion this year on recapture districts. There's 219 of those districts. And by 2023, if we don't do anything, that's going to increase to $5 billion.
Right.
So you got to offset those resources.
So do you start with an end goal and work backwards and essentially reconstruct or re-engineer the system so that the balance is a better balance?
Yes, that's ultimately the goal is.
Yeah.
Right now, if we don't do anything, the state will be funding 33% of the cost of education, which is about $60 billion.
And it was 45% in 2006.
Yes, sir.
Right.
Yep.
So where should it be?
Well, that's the question. You know,
where would you like it to be? Well, let's do fan fiction for the moment. Fantasyland.
We want to stop the slide, and you know, we need to be pushing it to get back to the high 30s or 40% or things of that nature, right? So those are things that have to happen. The answer is this: if you get a 50%, the cost of 50% is $30 billion. It's pretty simple math. If you're spending 60, 50% is $30 billion.
Right.
Well, we remind people of this. The people that are paying the taxes, whether you're paying property tax, they're us. These are the people that are paying those taxes.
This is a great Connie Burton line as Connie Burton exits the stage from the legislature. You know, people talk about property taxes and the state share of funding as if somehow we're not paying both of those.
Right, that's right.
That's all our money.
That is, absolutely. Right? It's just the difference is that if you think about sales tax and consumption taxes and things of that nature, more people are sharing in the pain. And people that are coming through our state are paying for those things versus just putting the majority of the burden on the property tax owners, and whether it's commercial properties or residential properties. And so I think that while the number hasn't been defined or agreed to, I can tell you that I know that it's significant. And the new speakers,
but it's not 50%.
No, I don't. It's so expensive.
Yeah, but isn't it even more expensive than we think? Because you not only have to raise the state's contribution to public ed, but unless you're going to basically call this a wash,
right?
To reduce property taxes, increase the state's share, you've got to then, over and above that, do even more.
You got to find some other mechanism.
So it's not enough to simply go from 33 to 40 and to take that amount of money that you're adding to the state's ticket and reduce that amount of property taxes. You then have to go above that.
Yeah, and one of the things that was interesting is, Paul Betancourt was the Senator Betancourt was the one that ran the revenue side, and he actually, came up with a variety of different ideas and concepts. And we put other ideas in the report. But the one he talked about, the what we'd call the Economic Stabilization Fund. Well, we're completely, it's at a point where there's different things that we can do. And I'll give you another example. Like the GLO, they're statutory limited to only give us $600 million a year. They're performing very well.
You could bust the cap.
You could bump. Well, no, you'd have to statutorily change it so that they have the ability.
Yes,
they have the ability to
give you more.
Give me more. To give us more money, so they could, say, hey, maybe if we're performing well, they have the ability to do that. Right now, they have the inability to do that.
The governor has talked about just as recently as yesterday in an interview with our reporter Patrick Svitek, he floated the possibility of diverting oil and gas tax revenue it's now flowing into the rainy day fund to create a sustainable. Education fund. Is that a good idea?
I think that
pretty volatile source of revenue.
It is. And so the question really when Senator Betancourt, this was one of his recommendations. So
when he talked about the rainy day fund, he meant could you possibly take money that's going into that and redirect it?
Has it become a stable source of revenue? It is volatile because you think about the price of oil and whatnot. And
just in the last couple of months when the price of oil has gone back below $50, you'd be sweating it if you knew that was coming.
Yep.
Right?
And you have people like Representative King, Ken King, who was on the panel, who's his family made a living in the oil and gas business over the years, brought up other good points. He said, if energy is going to be the source, then we need to talk about all forms of energy in the state of Texas as a source of revenue for education.
Which is not the case. Currently, that's the money that's going into the rainy day fund is oil and gas severance taxes.
Right.
It's not renewables.
It's not the other things. Right. And he made an excellent point to that degree because you could fix that, volatility associated with that. But it has become theoretically a stream of revenue. Look, if we don't do it, and we know that we got Hurricane Harvey and some of these other things that you got to pay for, that that'll be one-time sources of money. But ultimately, the comptroller's saying, look, if you just leave it, you're going to end up at $13 or $14 billion.
He said $15.4 billion by the end of the biennium. And of course, he's been advocating for taking a certain portion of that and investing it in the market because he thinks it's too much money.
Right. Absolutely.
Right.
And changing the investment policies for these guys. It's insane.
Do you think this legislature, which is a slightly more open to the idea of spending money legislature than the last one, just given the way that the partisan split narrowed, do you think this legislature is okay with the idea of using the rainy day fund for something that, let's be honest, is not really a one-time expense, which has been the tradition?
Right.
If you fund public education, it is something that you're committing to funding over time.
But I think it comes down to the simple math problem of, if you want property tax reform, if you want property tax relief, there's only certain levers that we can pull. And we got to figure out how to do that. And right now, constitutionally, we've taken some of these resources for transportation needs as an example.
Yep.
But you fully funded that. So there's
and frankly, people after the fact have complained that what you've done is put handcuffs on yourselves at the beginning of every session.
That's right.
You've got to take that money and parcel that off. It's almost like you're losing.
Your
freedom.
Yeah, right. And I think that's really the gist of what we're trying to get to is say, okay, what streams of revenues are going to exist? Where is the money at? And then, you know, if Controller Hager, you know, had the ability to have more flexibility. Obviously, I think, you know, in any market, you have to be careful and conservative with your investment policy. But basically, we're putting our money in a savings account with, you know, very low interest rate. Yeah, it makes no sense.
You wouldn't do that in your own house.
No, of course not.
As it actually happens. You mentioned recapture. Mm-hmm. Was this just a bad idea all along and we didn't understand it? Or was it a good idea that went bad? What happened? You know, you come from the Houston area. Mm-hmm. You know that the city of Houston has been in a fight with TEA over their recapture payment. I live in Travis County, Austin, which, you know, says to Houston, hold my beer, basically, right? Relatively speaking.
Yeah, right.
It's like three times or four times what Houston's paying. So where did this go wrong? What happened?
You know, the problem is, you know, as we sit here in your studio and I look around, Austin today.
It's crane, tower, right?
It looks much different than it did 10 years ago, even 10 years ago. And so while I empathize with Austin ISD and understand that their recapture payments were approaching $600 million. 10 years ago, these properties didn't exist. It's very expensive to live here too. And so those are some of the other reasons why it's causing that. They've got enrollment growth that's going down. You got values going up. I mean, those are the kind of things that's out there. But again, if you have to have, you know, property taxes to fund these things. And because of all these big buildings that are down here, there are school districts that are out there that don't have that same.
Yeah, but isn't part of the problem, I don't want to get all Andrew White running for governor on you, but isn't part of the problem that the commercial appraisals are not what they ought to be, that there's forgiveness for businesses on the property appraisal side, and if we simply ask people to pay what their appraisals ought to be as opposed to the breaks that people on the commercial side of things get, there's potentially another $5 billion to put into the system.
Well, but
I realize it's a tax increase.
Yeah, sure.
I get that.
Yeah.
But if we're talking about property taxes funding, let's talk about it honestly.
But the reality is in most commercial properties, the tenants are paying the property taxes. You're paying it through your CAM charge. I mean, and so if you
don't think there's money to be
gotten
from that.
because you're basically that you're just creating another tax on the business. And I dealing in the commercial real estate world,
this
I understand.
This is your world.
Yeah, I get it. I understand what the concerns are, what people have. But I assure you the appraisal districts have been pretty consistent. I know Harris County, you can't chase a sale here in Texas, but they do a pretty darn good job of figuring out, you know, what the value of a property is, and make it equitable for everybody along the ways. And so I think that I know people want to do that, and I've had to explain this to people over and over and over again. I said, you know, it's not the easy fix. It gets to the point where you sit there and say, you could, you know, from a developer's perspective or anybody else's perspective, you know, these guys are passing those costs on to you, the tenant. And so you obviously it becomes untenable to be able to pay rent here.
And no favorable election cycle to Democrats is favorable enough to get a serious conversation about tax increases in this legislature, not at a time when the economy is growing.
Yeah, no. And I think that if you look at what we've done, and we had cuts that we've made over the last several legislative sessions, you know, billions of dollars of cuts, and obviously created incentives for the oil and gas business and things of that nature. The economy is doing very well, obviously.
Right.
And so those are things you don't want to start messing with by doing that, you know. But we do have to do the way the property taxes have to get reduced. I mean, on the residential side for sure, because you're taxing people out of their homes.
But Chairman, you know what happened at the end of last session. At the end of last session, there was a proposal in the House that talked about going to the voters with a property tax increase of greater than 6%.
Right.
In the Senate, it was 4%.
Right.
There was no way to bridge that. The thing died.
Right.
Get through the special session. There's no property tax legislation. And the governor comes back during the campaign season and says 2.5%.
Right.
If you couldn't pass that stuff before, honestly, how are you going to pass it now?
Well, I think here's the difference.
Same local officials are going to complain about it.
No, I completely understand. Let's start with the school districts, which makes the majority. That's where the focus is at now.
Right.
Is my understanding. He's also talked about, you know, on the county side and everything else. But the 70% of your taxes are school taxes, driven school taxes. What we proposed in our school finance commission plan actually would work well with this type of plant, because we're talking about increasing the yield on the pennies, on the tier two pennies specifically. We've got 399 school districts that are at $1.17 or higher. There's 450 school districts. There's roughly, you know, call it 1,080 school districts that are out there. 450 are at $1.04 or higher. And so that's the majority of, you know, they have a higher tax rate. So if we can compress the tax rate, you can bring it down, you buy it down. It gives them flexibility, and meaning that the state is going to continue to contribute their share of the budget. And we've created incentives for the fast growth school districts as well. That's where part of the problem would initially have rested last year, is that we said, okay, there's your limit. You can't take advantage of this, but you're, you know, adding 1,500 kids a year, and figure out how to pay for it with less money.
Right.
That doesn't work. So we recognize that you have to have, again, it's part of the whole plan.
Right, but as you know, the larger conversation about property tax relief last session turned to this idea that cities and counties are having to take on an increasing share of providing basic services to local residents, and what the state is proposing is essentially handcuffs on those elected officials, saying you can't raise adequate revenue to do what you need to do without going to the voters. I know that that's accountability of a form, but elections are accountability, Chairman. If you don't like what your council member does or your county commissioner does, you vote him out of office. That's the tradition. Right. Why do you need to put this additional set of handcuffs on?
Yeah, I think what we've seen over the years, specifically on the residential side. Now, we had a little bit of a different issue this last year, and certainly in Houston, with Hurricane Harvey.
Right,
and we actually saw property taxes drop and valuations drop, and so created a different problem significantly, and created revenue problems for the state, because the state, you know, under the current situation, has to pick up the difference associated with that. You know, I know that there will be people that are going to be engaged in this discussion, whether it's through our Ways and Means Commission, Speaker Bonin is going to be involved talking about this and working with the governor on that. The plan that we went through specifically for the School Finance Commission just dealt with
the school part.
Piece of it. But you gotta put the money in the right places to make it work.
As you read the room, you think there is more of a likelihood that this gets done, something that could not get done where it was a big point of contention. Clearly, at the end of the session, people's nerves were frayed.
Sure.
They were mad at one another, House and Senate, Governor. Yeah. We're starting fresh. Yeah. You think there's more of a chance of it getting done now?
I do. And the good news is that, you know, we have a roadmap. We know where we want to go, and I understand, you know, whether you know I'm in charge or not, or whoever's going to be in the process. We're going to have multiple people involved in this process as we go forward, and there will be things that get added to the bill, obviously. But yeah, I really do. I feel like you know, the speaker has said, you know, that this is the most important thing to him. And he means it.
He's put a marker down, and the lieutenant governor and the governor, at least as of now, are singing from the same book.
Absolutely. And you know, they had, you know, they're meeting and they're talking and they're visiting, and you know, Larry and I are talking and visiting, and we did that all throughout last year in the commission, and you know, I think people are you know, and that's the number one question people are asking. Hey, what do you think? What are we going to do? You know. And so we're talking to new members and explaining.
And at least now it's optimism.
Absolutely.
I was struck by something Chairman Brister said at TPPF, at the Texas Public Policy Foundation policy orientation today, as we sit here January 9th. He said, related to the question of putting more money into public ed, the main issue is whether we're spending money well, not whether we need to add to it. You yourself have said the answer is not always more money.
Right.
We go into this conversation assuming more money is an answer or the answer, but the reality is we need to almost think about it from the other side. That is, there are people who say, we're not giving any more money to public education until public education demonstrates to us that they can spend the money that they have now efficiently. So I guess my question is, does the education community ask too much of the state and not enough of themselves at a moment like this? Do they have something to demonstrate to you in terms of their willingness to show that they can work in a system like this?
I think that, you know, and what the chairman was speaking specifically about was the outcomes. And what do we expect our kids, the 60 by 30 plans? We expect third graders to be able to read. That's a novel approach, huh? We expect, you know, that we fund.
And the numbers on that are terrible.
Oh,
right?
Yeah.
The third grade numbers are just off.
They're horrible. I mean, less than 40%.
Right.
I mean, that's just not sustainable. And so in early education, putting resources into that. So his comment and a lot of the stuff that we worked on and worked with Todd Williams from Commit Dallas,
right.
I mean, they've proven that it works. They went from 40 IR campuses in Dallas ISD to down to 3. In a very short period of time. I mean, it's just phenomenal work. I mean, what they did was just very unique stuff. It's hard to do. It's hard to get people to commit to this kind of stuff.
Right.
And there's going to be a lot of skeptical people. But I'll tell you what, if I was a school board member or I was a superintendent and looking at the entirety of this plan, I'd figure out every single way to get these incentives to figure out how to get the resources.
So you think the education community will be willing to be held accountable because holding themselves and being held accountable is essentially the reward.
Absolutely.
Or produces the reward.
Absolutely.
At the other end.
Yeah. And you know, we were very collaborative through this process with these schools and the school districts and the variety of them. And we talked about a lot of different ideas and concepts. And, you know, we want them to be part of the process.
They know this is coming.
Yeah. We don't want to shove stuff down their throat. But at the same time, we're just not going to, you know, pump. You know, we're just not going to take $5 billion and say, put in the basic allotment and leave the current system.
See you at the Christmas party.
Yes. See you next time, right?
Right.
Yes. That's not happening. That's not, you know, look. And this, in my view, should be as bipartisan as possible. The report was unanimous from the commission. As you mentioned,
Correct.
We had Republicans and Democrats.
Right.
And we all, you know, there's certain
you
things.
You get Diego Bernal and Paul Bettencourt on the same page, you've accomplished something.
Absolutely, 100%, right?
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. So you mentioned a speaker. Speaker has now apparently been ordering cups that are in the members lounge that say, school finance reform, the time is now. I was hoping you'd bring me a sleeve of cups for our kitchen. You take him at his word.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know him well. You've been in there a long time. Of course, he's been in longer than a lot of people in the building now, but you know him for a long time.
Yep.
You take the governor and lieutenant governor at their word.
I do.
You did not necessarily have a rosy view of the other chamber or the other chamber's presiding officer at the end of last session.
You know, I think that the perspective, time heals.
Time passes.
Time heals all wounds. You know, yeah. Governor Patrick and I have known each other a very, very long time and have, you know, been colleagues and collegial and whatnot. Everybody gets...
Frankly, on issues, you tend to agree more than not.
Oh, of course. Right? Absolutely, yeah. And we worked on major things together, like, you know, banning Common Core. That was a bill that he and I worked on together in the 13th legislative session.
Right.
You know, and what I reminded people was that, you know, the elections are over. Now we have to govern.
Yep.
And we need to get along. And I'm very optimistic, obviously, with our leader, Speaker Bonnet.
You talked to him a lot in the interim, did you not about this?
I did, absolutely.
Before he knew and you knew that he'd be speaking.
That's right. Absolutely. Right. And he's always been an advocate for education and for us and talks about the issues. And you know, he mentioned it the other day. Education's critical for him. You know, he was dyslexic. I'm dyslexic. And those common thread that we share. So
it's probably not an exaggeration to say he felt saved by public education.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. And that's just a phenomenal story. And so, you know, and Larry, Chairman Taylor and I, you know, been collaborative and working through this process. And I've visited with Governor Patrick and we've had nice conversations and talked about it. But, you know, to the degree that that's there, that becomes above my pay grade, that's a relationship that.
But
I know.
From your perspective, it's a clean slate. You're willing to start.
Absolutely,
start
of course, start yeah, absolutely. And I think that's where everybody's at. I think that you can't go back and look at in the rearview mirror if you want to keep going forward. And so we're prepared to continue to work with them.
Right.
You know, and that's what everybody said. Gosh, it's kumbaya. And I said, well, it's day one. Come talk to me in April.
Yeah,
you know?
It's not going to be kumbaya.
We'll run into problems and that's just the way the process.
Do you think these last elections told leadership there's a political price to be paid for not getting it done this time?
I think so.
You do?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there was a lot of common threads. There was a lot of issues. You know, you had some you know rock star-y type candidates that were out there. It made a huge difference. I looked at some of the numbers. You know, the millennials voted. The younger people voted.
Right.
I mean, they came out and they...
People of color voted.
They everybody, you know, and we turned out, you know, as Republicans, we turned out as many people as we could possibly turn out.
They just turned out more.
Yeah, and the results just went there. I mean, you know, you lose Mike Schofield as an example on the west side of
Not
Harris
County. Not a lot of people saw that coming.
No, No, we didn't. You know, we knew that we had problems here in Austin. You know,
you knew you had problems in Dallas.
We knew we had problems in Dallas. You know, and we tried to, you know, help those guys. But I mean, you know, there we couldn't have done anything to help Tony or Paul. And those guys were very strong supporters.
And so you think you get education done, you have a chance to go back to the voters and say we did the business of the state. You don't get education done, they're not going to give you another chance.
There's no doubt in my mind. Right. Yeah. And next session's redistricting. Right. So good luck with that.
Good luck with that. Yeah. Quickly, will you be chair again?
I serve at the pleasure of the speaker.
That's not an answer, and you know it is not an answer.
I serve at the pleasure of the speaker.
You had a conversation with him about wanting to be chair again. Let me say it this way. Did you say to him, Mr. Speaker, I would like to be chair again?
Speaker Bonner and I have had multiple conversations about a variety of issues, and looking forward. We get our preference cards today. And
so you fill yours out?
I'll be it's back at the office.
I so hear that Ways and Means needs a chairman. Did you ask to be that?
I did not. But you know, the beauty of
it's not a possibility. There's no possibility that you or you're not thinking you won't be. You just don't know that you will be.
I need to be selected to be on the committee first, and so you know I'm going to you know use my preferences to do that. I've spent a lot of time.
And you will indicate at least you can tell me.
I'd like to be. To be involved in the process, and he's been very good. You know, with members, that's the thing about Speaker Bonner. He is a members member, and he's driving the train, as we call it.
Of course, Speaker Strauss used to say, I govern the House by the will of the members. Absolutely. He would describe himself in that same way.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. But, you know, as you know, we've had a change of the guard, and Speaker Strauss was very gracious and kind to me
believed in what you did.
Absolutely. He was a huge supporter, and so was at the time Speaker Pro Tem Bonner was a huge supporter of what we were doing, and me personally. And so I think that the beauty of it is that I've been asked this question a lot, and I tell people, and this is the honest truth. I serve in a capacity where he wants me. And
put me in wherever you want to coach.
Put me where you want me to work hardest and get things done. But I know that based on the work that I've done, and certainly Ken King, Diego Bernal, on the House side that have been working hard on this, is that, you know, people that understand this, because it's complex, and most people didn't pay attention to what we did. You know, we had 40 meetings. I mean, people don't have time to pay attention to that stuff. So part of it is educating everybody as we go forward, and I think there'll be multiple people that would have opportunities. We expanded the committee. We took it from 11 to 13, so more people will have a seat at the table.
Well, it's a good get if you're a member.
Yeah.
That's how it goes.
Yeah.
Last time I interviewed you, let me say at the beginning of the last legislative session, so about 2 years ago, you cautioned everybody in the audience, cautioned me, we're not going to fix this problem in one session.
Right.
This is where you are now. Rome cannot be built in one day.
That's right.
So we shouldn't go into this session, even with all the optimism in the world, and believe we're going to solve the problem in one session.
Well, the difference between last year and this year, I think, is twofold. Number one, we did some nip and tuck around the edges. This time is holistic change. It's going to be significant. It's going to be significant changes. But anytime you pass a significant large piece of legislation, you always find holes after it gets implemented, as an example. So my suspicion will be is that the recommendations, there were over 30 recommendations, if you plugged all those things in, not everything's going to work perfectly, right? So you're going to come back and try and do that. But this is the time to have the major conversation about what this is going to look like for the next 20 to 30 years. And I really believe, based on the conversations that I've had with Speaker Bonin and his leadership team, staff, our staff, the governor, he even said it yesterday, and I'm sure at the State of the State he'll bring this up again, is that, and certainly the Lieutenant Governor, I'm sure in his remarks he has been saying the same thing. The expectation is that for the members to fix this and to come up with a plan, and it's going to be hard. But last session we had 133 people vote for it. I think that we'll come up with something that the goal would be is that everybody would vote for it. I would think that would be a horrible vote to say no. I'm against this one little thing, so I'm not going to vote for the plan. But as you know, legislation like this takes a life of its own once it hits the floor, too.
We'll see what happens.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman or Mr. Chairman for now?
Yes.
Thank you for being here.
You bet.
All right.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Point of Order, the newest member of the Texas Tribune's family of podcasts. Thanks to our guest, State Representative Dan Huberty, and thanks to the sponsors of this episode, Educate Texas, the Texas Education Grantmakers Advocacy Consortium, and Raise Your Hand Texas. Be sure to check out the Tribune's deep coverage of the 86th legislative session at texastribune.org. And if you like what you see there or hear here, tell your friends about us. Until next time, I'm Evan Smith.